Welcome to Finding Joy with Kara. Today, my guest is Jana Himes. She is the enthusiastic, energetic conductor of the Carmel Symphony Orchestra, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have her on the show today. She has amazing energy and goes a million miles an hour when she's sitting still. I hope you enjoy this one. Jana, thank you for joining me today. It's exciting to be able to see you through this medium anyway, through the computer. Thank you so much for being on Finding Joy with Kara.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk with you.
I would love to know how you got into conducting. I know this could be a really long story. I'm good with that. Okay. I would love to know your background. I know that you grew up in New York. Is that right? And that you commute. So you're the conductor for the Carmel Symphony Orchestra, first female. And I would love to know how you got inspired. What was your journey to being where you are now?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll try to be as succinct as I can. So I started piano lessons when I was a little girl. I grew up on the Upper West Side in New York City, and I had two older brothers, and music was really my thing. It was my thing that I could own and be separate from my brothers. You know, they were competitive. They were into sports. They were amazing big brothers, but this was my thing. So when I had my piano lessons and I practiced, nobody got in my way. And I owned it and I loved it. And I got very good very quickly. And music was a very natural thing for me. Our parents took us to, especially me, to the ballet and the opera and the symphony. And so we were ensconced in that cultural, vibrant part of New York City, which is everywhere. And so I decided when I was in about eighth grade, I wanted to go to the High School of Music and Art. And music and art at that time was up in Harlem. And my parents were, you know, really questioning whether this was the right move to do. But I was insistent and I applied. I got in on piano. And the first day of school, I was in ninth grade now. And they said, well, you need to be in the band, the orchestra, or the choir. And I said, okay, well, I'd like to be in orchestra because I'd love to play another instrument. So they gave me the trumpet and I went home that night and I told my parents I was going to be playing the trumpet. And they said, no, you're not. We're not hearing you practice the trumpet in this apartment. Even though we lived in one of those pre-war buildings with 9 rooms and 18-foot ceilings, it was a beautiful apartment, which I would kill for today. They didn't want to hear me practice the trumpet. So my mother said, well, that's for the flute or violin. So, you know, very typical, right? So I went back. I said, well, can I play the flute or violin? Because I really didn't care. I just wanted to be in orchestra. So they said, how about the cello? So I went home. It was all agreed upon that I studied the cello. There were 4 orchestras in my high school, and I was in the beginning orchestra because I had never played cello before. I advanced very quickly. And I also took private cello lessons. So I studied with Martin Ormandy, who was the brother of the great conductor Eugene Ormandy, and he played in the Lincoln Center Orchestra, the mostly Mozart symphony. So I was taking piano lessons, I was taking cello lessons, and I was really immersed in school. And we had a lot of music history and theory, and we had math and English and all that too, but it was very, very heavy on music. So I was in 10th grade at this point when this happened, and now I'm in the best orchestra. I'm in the back of the section, but I'm in the top orchestra. And it was my goal to be in that orchestra because that orchestra played at Carnegie Hall for graduation. And I thought, I've got to do that. So I'm in the back of the section and the conductor wasn't there. So we're all kind of fooling around. The percussionists are throwing their sticks. Everyone's fooling around and just playing the wrong instruments. And it was bad. So I went up to the podium. I said, come on, guys, let's just play. And they were like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, we were working on Beethoven's First Symphony. And I said, we might as well play. Conductor's not here. And they went like that. And they all played the first chord. And that was so long ago. But when I tell you the story, I can remember it today. I can remember the feeling I had.
So since this is audio, let me explain. Jana raised up her arms and she started them on the first beat. And that control and that magic, that's when it sparked with you.
That is exactly the moment. And I conducted for about 20 minutes. No idea what I was doing. I had no music in front of me. I just mimicked what I remembered the conductor had done previously. Conductor walks in. Thank you, Jana. I went back to my cello seat and I thought, I don't want to do this. I want to do that. So I went home that night and I told my parents I was going to be a conductor. Now I'm in 10th grade, so I'm 15. And my father said, we're going to support you, whatever you want to do. But it's a really hard field for women, there aren't that many. My mother just, you know, slaps him and says, shut up, Phil. She can be whatever she wants to be. And they were my biggest fans. And I've been doing it ever since. And it's been a long journey. And it's been, you know, my reason for wanting to do it was the magic of hearing the sound when I moved my body. But then realizing that music history, learning the instruments, all the transpositions, all the repertoire, then the work started to hit me of what I needed to do. And I've never looked back. It's really the only thing I've ever done. I waited tables in college for extra money. I did babysitting in high school and stuff, but I never really did anything else. And it's funny because people ask me, what would I do if I was going to do something else? And I can't even answer the question. It's so embedded in really who I am. So that's kind of my beginning story of how I started to conduct.
That is amazing, because most people well into their 50s may not know what they want to do with the rest of their life. And you knew instinctively at 15.
I did. And I also knew it was going to be hard for a woman.
Right. And so where did you go to college and how did you work your way into leading an orchestra?
I decided to go to the University of Wisconsin for undergrad. And the reason was that I had been studying in France one summer. It was a music program. And my parents sent me to this phenomenal summer camp. And I met these girls that went to Wisconsin. They were not music majors, but they were so fun. They were so great. They were from the Chicago area. So I went to Wisconsin, which was a Big Ten school. And I really wanted to get out of the city. I really wanted to have my own space. Music can be an insular thing. It can be something that's very private, where you're either practicing or studying by yourself many hours a day. And I wanted more of that. And I wanted to go and study at a Big Ten school. I wanted a lot of classes in various things. So I took a French women writers class. I took conducting. I played the piano. I did so many different things at that school. And I didn't want to go to a conservatory and only do music. I wanted a really broad education. So I went there for 4 years. I loved it. My best friend was my roommate. She's still my best friend today. I could not get a conducting undergrad degree. They didn't offer that, but I got a music theory and piano degree. And then I went to graduate school after that. I went to the Cincinnati Conservatory. But in between, I came back to New York and I studied with Otto Werner Mueller, who was a great, great conducting teacher. At the time, he was at Yale, and then he ended up going to Curtis, and he also taught at Juilliard. And he was 6'7", German, amazing, amazing conducting teacher. And I loved him so much. I learned probably 90% of what I do today from him. And he gave me a lot of encouragement. You know, women were not really doing this. There were like a handful of us. My goal was someday I'm going to be a mom and I'm going to keep conducting. So those were the two things. I was just laser focused on those two things my entire life.
So in these classes, what percentage were women? Like how large are these courses and how many were men? What did that look like?
So in Cincinnati, there were no other women. I was the only woman in that program. But when I studied with Otto Werner Mueller, it was private. And I would go to his house. He would sit on the couch and I would stand looking at him with no music in front of me, no music playing. And I would conduct the pieces we were working on. And he could tell by my movements what I was doing and if I was doing it right. And he would say, oh, you forgot the second oboe there just by watching me. And you could hear that. So we had the music in our heads. It was like telepathic. It was unbelievable. And he grilled me. He worked me so hard. And I did that for like 3 years. And I just loved him. He had a great sense of humor. His wife was a vocalist and he made me take voice lessons with her because he wanted me to understand what vocalists go through and how they breathe and how they move. It wasn't to be a vocalist. It was just to understand because I'm always going to be working with singers. So he was just amazing. I loved him. And when I went to Cincinnati, he was a little angry with me. I think he wanted me to follow him in one of his schools, but I was ready to go back to a conservatory and go back to a big school. So I got a full ride to a Cincinnati Conservatory and I was there for 3 years and just loved the program. Got a lot of experience. I would put concerts together with my friends and have faculty play solos. And I just had so much energy. And I would say, let's just do a Mozart concerto. I'll get an orchestra together. We'll do it in a month. And I would get the hall. I would just get everybody together, print the program, print posters. And I just ran around doing this stuff. And it was just second nature for me. And when I came back to New York after that, I got my first job. I was working with a youth orchestra. And the minute I started working, I've just been working ever since. I've had an incredible journey. And I think of all the things that I've done in my career, competitions, and I worked with Leonard Bernstein. And I've conducted in Europe. I was a Fulbright scholar in Italy.
rewind. We need to talk about Leonard Bernstein.
Okay.
So when did you meet him? Talk about that situation and your relationship.
So I went to the Tanglewood Music Festival in 1989, and Leonard Bernstein was going to be coming. He came every summer for a portion of the summer. And a lot of people went to Tanglewood for that very reason. And in that class, there were two female conductors. It was a pretty big class. I would say there were about maybe 14 conductors. And we heard that Leonard Bernstein was coming to class that week, and we were all super excited. We had been working with Gustav Meyer. He was the teacher, and he was great. And he knew that we were all excited for Bernstein to come. And I think it might have been a little hard for him because we were all really jazzed. I mean, we loved him, but we couldn't wait to meet Bernstein. So he walks into the room, and first of all, he was much shorter than I imagined. And I grew up in New York, but I missed the Leonard Bernstein years. My brothers went to those young people's concerts that he put on for kids that were amazing. I have them on video, but I didn't see them in person. I was too young. So he walks in, and he has a guy behind him who had his coffee thermos. I'm not sure there was coffee in there, but he had his thermos and his towel and followed him around. And so he was kind of short, and he walked in, but his presence, the minute he walked in the room, he filled it. It was just him. He was huge. His energy was all encompassing. And he walked in, and we had picked numbers to see who would conduct because we were all dying to conduct for Bernstein. So there were about five people before me, and he stopped them and fixed and did things. And it was, you know, incredible, right? He would say, do this, do that. And they did it, and it sounded better and looked better. And so I got up to conduct, and I was doing a Brahms symphony, and this was unbelievable. Again, I'm feeling it like right now. So he asked me to begin, and I began, and about 15 minutes went by, and he didn't stop me. And at first I didn't notice that, but then after a while, all I could think of is he's not stopping me like he did everybody else. Why isn't he stopping me? He must hate me. So that was going like kind of through my head, which was very natural for a young conductor because Leonard Bernstein was about 10 feet away from me. So I just kept going, and we got to the end of the movement, and he came up to me and he took my face in his hands and he kissed me right on the lips. Kid you not. And he said, you can do this. You can be a conductor. It's going to be a lot of work, but you're on your way. And so I was kind of shaking inside. I kind of felt sick, and I sat down, and then the next person went. And so it was the end of the day, and everybody came running up to me. What did he say? What did he say? And when I said what he said, they were all kind of like, really? And I said, yes, that's what he said. You know, I mean, we're in our 20s, right? So I kind of floated through the afternoon, and everyone heard about this. The composition students, the conducting students, everybody heard about it. So they were all like, whoa, Jana, whoa, whoa, whoa. So the next day he walks in, we have maybe seven more conductors he hadn't seen yet. And he walks in class and he says, I want to start with Jana. And, you know, all of a sudden I had seven enemies because they hadn't conducted for Bernstein yet. And his time was limited and everybody wanted to, you know, to work with him. So I get up, and now I'm doing Tchaikovsky, Romeo and Juliet. Same thing. He is just loving everything I'm doing. And the rest of the summer, he had me like with him. He wanted me near him. He wanted me just to listen to his stories and be just by his side. And so I stayed with him the rest of the summer, just like his little minion. He was brilliant. He spoke many languages. He was so free in his being. He knew everything about food. He knew everything, of course, about music, but he lived life to the fullest. When he became friends with the Black Panthers in New York City, of course he did. You know, why wouldn't he have done that? When he decided to step out of his marriage, of course he did. He wanted to live life in every possible degree that he could. And it was extraordinary to be around that. I didn't grow up in a family that was strict by any means, but I was around greatness and such freeness. I don't even know if that's a word, freedom of being. You know, nothing was big enough for him. And I sort of love that, but I also was a little afraid of that because I think you can get into a lot of trouble with that type of personality. But I still was intrigued. And the fact that he chose me as somebody that he felt connected to or that he wanted to be with or spend any time with was sort of shocking. Sadly for me, he didn't live much longer. And so I didn't really have much time with him after that. But it was a summer never to forget. And one anecdote here, which I think is so funny, about 10 years later, maybe 15 years later, I had met one of the musicians that was playing in that day when he whispered in my ear. He said, oh God, do you remember what Bernstein said to you? Wasn't that amazing? And I said, tell me what he said to me, because I wanted to make sure I didn't dream it or imagine it. He said, Jana, what do you mean? You don't remember? I said, well, just tell me. I want to hear it from somebody else. He said, remember, he said, you can do this. It's going to be hard, but you're going to be great. You can do this. I said, oh, yeah, I remember. Just wanted to double check. But yeah, when I've ever had a bad day or a bad time or feeling low or just like, how am I going to get through this? I think of that and it just pulls, I'm snapped out of it.
This episode is sponsored by Adam Gibson Design, an architectural design firm specializing in luxury homes, full home design, remodels, additions, and kitchen and bath. The Adam Gibson Design team is known for an infusion of natural light, clean lines, warmth, efficient use of space, and most importantly, a healthy design. The Adam Gibson Design team designs for living. Visit adamgibsondesign.com to learn more. Jana's first job post-college was with conducting a youth orchestra in Stanford, Connecticut. She was so excited to get the job that she was shocked that she didn't have to pay them to hire her. It was here that she learned a lot about what happens off the podium. She learned who sits where, figured out what she wanted people to play during auditions, who she was going to bring in, and creating the full repertoire. Her first professional job after the youth orchestra was with the Canton Symphony in Ohio. She was their number two conductor, and it was during that phase that she got pregnant with her first son.
So now I'm starting to put my whole life together, right? I'm starting to figure out how to be a mom, which was something I wanted. I knew that I wanted. You know, I think a lot of people who choose this profession decide there's no room. And I get it. It's very hard to do that. But that was important to me. But so I was with Canton and I had my first son there. And then I moved up the ranks. I went to the Charlotte Symphony, had my second son there. And then I went to the Indianapolis Symphony. And then when I left Indianapolis, I had been doing this number two for a while and I was done. And I thought, you know, I just got to focus. I want to focus now on really me and what I want to do next. My husband at the time and I, we moved to Maine for many reasons. My parents were in New York. We loved Maine. We wanted the kids to be able to have a life that was filled with opportunity. They, you know, to this day, they ski, they sail, they golf, they kayak. We wanted that type of life for them. And I wanted to just slow down. So we moved there. And then I started some interesting things. I started my own orchestra. The mission was to hire only Maine musicians and play throughout the state. And we went into schools and we did Peter and the Wolf all around the state. And we got a lot of money to do this great stuff. And it was really fun. And that gave me another whole part of my job. I learned all the administrative, how to raise money, how to work with the board, how to write press releases, how to do grants. It was a really great experience. It was a lot of work and I didn't get much sleep, but I was able to be with my kids and have that job. A couple of years of that, and I kept that orchestra going for 9 years. In fact, we still have our 501c3 status. Then I got my job as a music director of the Williamsburg Symphony, and I was there for 15 years. When I got there, it was the Williamsburg Symphonia. It was an okay, small regional orchestra. And over the years, we did amazing things. We played at the Bermuda International Music Festival. We did recordings. We grew. So we're now the Williamsburg Symphony. And we just got better and better. It's a really crackerjack orchestra in a town that is steeped with culture and tradition. So it was a wonderful place to work because I was able to get the support I needed to grow the whole orchestra and the whole administration and the whole organization. And I left at the peak. I applied to the Carmel Symphony and I won that position. And for 2 years, I did both orchestras. And then it was 15 years. And I thought it's time to say goodbye to Williamsburg. And it was very positive. It was bittersweet. And now I'm putting a lot of my energy into the Carmel Symphony, which, again, I've been here now 4 years. And when I got here, it was good. And it's just getting better every year. And we're having an amazing time with programming and seeing audience development and all kinds of exciting things, even through COVID. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
I saw you lead the orchestra with the tribute band to the Beatles this summer. That was so exciting to see, and outdoors, which was great. And let's talk a little bit about this season, because I know that we've talked about diversity and bringing that to classical music. And I know there's this fabulous opera that's playing at the Met that is written by a Black playwright. And so there's more influence in traditional white areas, I want to say, in music that are being more open to diversity and representation. And can you explain a little bit about how Carmel is addressing that?
I love that question. That's something that is so important to me because, you know, growing up in New York, my parents were so great. They were so cool. They were so amazing. And I mean, my father worked on Saturday Night Live. How could you not be amazing, right? So he saw every kind of personality you can imagine. And he just treated people like people. It didn't matter. Paul McCartney could be there and he'd be like, hey, Paul, you know, I mean, that's just how my father was. Questlove loved my dad, you know, would give my dad presents. And it's Questlove, you know, like, really? You know. So for me, I was brought up that you treat people with respect no matter where they're from, no matter what they do. So I've always programmed a wide variety of people, meaning now what everyone's doing, you know, bringing in Black composers and musicians, bringing in Spanish, bringing in women, I've always done. It's never been something that I thought, well, I really have to do that this year, because I was a minority. I was a female conductor and I went through crazy things with that in my career. I didn't get hired with one of the greatest orchestras in the world. And even though I won the audition from the orchestra's point of view, because I was a woman. And I know that for a fact. So I've had to deal with this, but I don't deal with it anymore. I don't care what people think. And it's not just since Me Too or Black Lives Matter or COVID. I've always, you know, stood for myself. But in the last 5-6 years, I've been like, hey, you know what? I'm not making excuses anymore. That question, what's it like to be a female conductor? Really? At this age and the fact that I've been doing this for so long, I can tell you what it's like to be a conductor, but the female question gets a little old. But getting back to your question, this year, and this was pre-COVID, so we're bringing Byron Stripling in January. He's a jazz trumpeter. He's the pops conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony, and I've worked with him before. He's amazing. He's incredible. He's doing a Louis Armstrong show. Incredible entertainer and player. We're bringing in the Harlem String Quartet. We're playing Florence Price next week. Florence Price was the first Black woman American to be played by a major orchestra, and that was the Chicago Symphony. But I had programmed that 2 years ago. So we do it naturally. It's important for people to see the community represented on stage. And even if you live in a community that's predominantly maybe wealthy or mostly white or whatever, it's still important for them to see or to recognize the fact that the world, the United States, the world is made up of a huge population of people. There's a lot of music I haven't done. I haven't done a lot of music from China. I haven't met a lot of music. I've done some music by Chinese musicians, but I haven't had a lot of those instrument soloists coming in, playing those incredible instruments that they have. I haven't done a lot of that, and some of my colleagues have. Or India, I haven't done a lot with sitar and stuff like that. I'd love to. And I have visions of maybe having a world festival where I can bring in amazing musicians from all around the world. I think that would be incredible. And I love all that stuff. But to play jazz, to bring in bluegrass musicians, to play ragtime, to do all those American types of music. I've been doing that my whole career. And I think it's important to represent a wide variety of music when you're programming. I don't think just doing Beethoven and Mozart is going to bring in the audience, especially here in Carmel. You know, it's really important for me to listen to the community. And I have been doing that. And it takes a while. You know, you get a job and you go to a new community and you might program the first year, but you need to meet people and you need to hear what they like. So we know that the pops is really successful here. So for next year, it's going to be out of the park. This year's amazing. We did the Beatles. We're doing an Earth, Wind & Fire concert coming up. We have John McLaughlin coming. He's a local celeb, Byron. We know that these concerts are going to be really appreciated by our audience. And also some of our classical concerts have music that is lighter. We're playing the Marquez Danzon No. 2. If you sit in your seat and don't move through that piece, then I don't think you have any heartbeat because we're playing that next week. I cannot wait to play this piece. I'm afraid that I'm going to be on the podium, like moving so much that everyone's going to be like, what is she doing? It's so energetic. It's based on a Cuban dance with Mexican rhythms. And we've got full percussion section that compared with the Florence Price piece, which was steeped in really Black church gospel plantation music and ragtime. I mean, what a great juxtaposition of music. We're trying to put music there that's going to bring everyone's heartbeat going a little faster so that they're excited to come and hear the Carmel Symphony.
That's awesome. I love that answer. And I love that you already feel like diversity is normalized. That's just part of the deal and bringing people on board. I think when you represent and are that role model, you attract more of that to the process. So bravo. And I'll support you in any way that I can on that. So what is next? You've got this season mapped out. What do we have coming up to look forward to? Are there any special projects that you have that you can talk about?
I can't announce anything yet, but I am so, so excited. In fact, we're working through 2024 now because some things are big and so it takes a while. But I am so excited about these collaborative things I'm working on.
When things shut down during the pandemic, Jana connected with friends she hadn't connected with in a while. And apparently, she is working on some pretty amazing collaborative efforts that she will share with us in time, but not yet.
It opened up so many possibilities. And those are some of the things I have been working on and I've brought to the symphony and they're all over it. They love these ideas. And what I want to do is I want to bring entertainment of the highest quality to Carmel and not have it always be educational where, hey, we're doing this piece. It's kind of heavy. It was written in the 19th century or the 20th century. I want to bring in music that people are going to come to the hall because they're interested and they want to hear what we have to say because what we say is through music. When I'm in front of the orchestra is when I speak the most and when my language is the most poignant and important. I'm more comfortable in a theater, walking into a theater, whether to see or hear something or perform something on stage, than I am going to a cocktail party. It's just where I'm most comfortable. I think that we use the orchestra to connect with people and to bring people together. And COVID was so devastating and horrible that people should come out and support that because we guarantee that when they come into the hall and they're with us, that they will feel through music and through the presence of being together, they will feel something special. And that is such an incredible thing to be part of. I wake up every day and I feel kind of a burden on my shoulders to do that. But I also feel great joy in knowing that's my job. That's what I do every day. I try to bring something that is so incredibly moving. It could be sad. It could be happy. It could be many different emotions. But people never leave the theater thinking, okay, that was good. Where are we going to dinner? It's always where they want to talk about it and that they're moved in some way. And that's a beautiful thing to be part of.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for all that you're doing for our community, for Maine, for everywhere that you've touched. Sounds like it's really been a wonderful journey for you throughout this process.
Yeah. It's been incredible. It's been hard. And I want to thank you. You're doing the same thing in a different medium. You know, you do the same thing. And I think that we're creative and we want to make things happen. It's not about fame. It's not about, oh, I want this. It's not about money either. It's about creating something that people react to. And you do the same thing. And that's why we connect. So I want to thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you for being here. High energy only begins to describe Jana Himes. I asked her when we were off the record what she listens to in the car. Like if she's got 20, 30 minutes in the car, what does she listen to? If she listens to the radio or a podcast, and of course I would hope she listens to this podcast, but she said she listens to pop music. Thank you all for listening to Finding Joy with Kara. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that you continue your journey to finding joy in your own life. Thank you.